Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
Breathing right now?
Yes, she's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Arak is the oldest spirit in the world. It's the mother spirit of all Anna spirits. I mean, even the word alcohol is an Arabic word. It comes from the word al-kuhul. It was the first distilled spirit that was globally shipped in places as far as Mongolia. Today, we refer to the category of spirits in itself to be arak. But arak in itself is basically a triple distilled grape brandy. It's usually enjoyed with a meal, where it slips slowly over the course of several hours with different types of mezze dishes. And it's a tradition in the Middle East that's been consumed since the 9th century.
Hello, hello. It's me, Whetstone co-founder and Point of Origin host, Steven Satterfield. It's been a few months since our last podcast, and the world that we left behind is so, so much different. With more sitting and reading and reflecting and contemplating, we can start to see plainly the ways in which our most vulnerable communities have always been the ones most closely bound to struggles for justice, land, and dignity. There is much to be garnered in understanding the past. We believe this so fiercely that we've dedicated our work to this premise entirely, centering concepts like origin, anthropology, and indigeneity. We considered our role in this moment of social uprising and the ways in which it is related to our work. At first, we thought of maybe doing an entire season through the filter of COVID-19 or the immense Black Lives Matter mobilization. But as we started to prepare for this season, what became clear is that the thing we do best is also the thing that is the most helpful in this moment. And that thing is absorbing and discussing food culture from the perspective of the global and the historical. We cannot comment intelligently on food, social uprisings, pandemics, or really anything in between with a perspective that is not international, intergenerational, and intersectional. So our plan for season 3 is the same as the first two, which is to explore the world of food worldwide. And in doing that, with the context that we provide and the people that we learn from, we hope helps us all understand the parts of our culture that are cyclical and collective, and how we can learn from past struggles to meet this moment with unprecedented education and empathy. With that, I'd like to welcome you all to Point of Origin Season 3. We begin with a trip to Palestine to discover the history behind the lesser-known spirit of arak. Whetstone contributing journalist Lyric Lewin brings us to the Muwadi Distillery. So, Lyric, you went to Palestine and met Nader and spent time on his land learning about Iraq, its history in Palestine, and how, for Nader, producing Iraq is a revival of sorts in terms of the tradition and also the methodology.
Yes, so arak is a spirit that is traditional in the Levant. It's distilled from indigenous grapes that are used in winemaking and infused with anise seeds. It's a really smooth drink with a kick of licorice to it. Most people are familiar with Italian Sambuca or with Ouzou from Greece, but not a lot of people know that those are all derived from the mother spirit, arak. The history of arak is really interesting because it evolved from the Arab invention of alembic distillation around the 8th century. And basically, alembics are these apparatuses used to distill or separate and purify substances. So they can be made from glass, ceramic, or copper, and they have two different parts. The bottom part will sit over a heat source, and that contains the substance that needs to be distilled. And then at the top is this bulb and tube sloping down and out so that when the vapors rise and flow through the tube, they can cool down and condense away from the heat source. So truly, Europe and the rest of the world would not have their Sambuca or Ouzou without this scientific invention from the Levant. And Muwadi Arak is made primarily with the Dubuki grape, which is one of many indigenous varietals in the West Bank. It's a white varietal that's large, round, sweet, and juicy. And Nader wants to make sure that he has as much juice per grape as possible because those will have a higher sugar content and that will yield the higher alcohol content.
So in Palestine, we have 23 indigenous species of grapes. About maybe, you can say 8 or 9 of them are suitable for wine, three of which are white varietals, so that I use for my arak. I use primarily Dabuki, but there's also Hamdani and Jandali. The Jandali, you can tell that the berries are smaller, but they're much sweeter.
The traditional way of growing vines in Palestine is in these beautiful goblet vines. The farmers grow the vines straight up like a little tree, basically. So there's no trellising. And that way, due to the harsh sun, the canopies of leaves can serve as protection for the grapes. Here's what Nader had to say.
Growing up in the States, for me, I had a very bicultural upbringing. At school, we spoke English, but when I came home, we spoke Arabic. On the weekends, we spoke Arabic. And whenever we had public holidays, whether it was Thanksgiving or the 4th of July, we always had a small gathering of the Philadelphia Palestinian community. Mm-hmm. And in those gatherings, we always had Palestinian food, and we always had arak. It's the drink that's synonymous with our cuisine. It goes best with our food. And we always had Lebanese arak. I don't remember any Palestinian arak ever being available there. And the brands we had, they were good. I mean, we had Razouk, we had Masai, we had a couple of good brands out there. And I loved arak. For me, at the time, when I was younger, I used to drink whatever. But over the years, I sort of realized that I don't enjoy beer or wine as much as I enjoy arak. When I was drinking, I would drink whatever. But now, when you want to drink for pleasure, I enjoy arak because it just goes best with the food that we eat here. Coming back here in 2007, I remember I couldn't find good arak. I used to enjoy arak in the States, but the arak in the local market, it was just I don't want to shoot anyone down, but it wasn't on par.
Sure.
It burnt. Going down, it didn't have the flavor. It didn't have the viscosity, the aroma. It was just commercial, you can say. Mm. And basically what I used to do is, Lebanese products coming into Palestine, because Israel and Lebanon are technically at war. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get Lebanese goods into the West Bank because the West Bank is occupied by Israel. So whenever I would go to Jordan, which is, a couple hours trip,
yeah.
I would always, pick up some arak at the duty free, and they usually had popular Lebanese brands, and I'd bring them in, with my suitcase or in a duty free bag or whatever. And sometimes, if I didn't have any on me and I had a gathering of friends who wanted to go out, have a barbecue, do whatever, I'd stop by a liquor store and you'd always find the local arak, and then you'd find one bottle of some Lebanese brand, but it would be $100 per bottle, and it got expensive and it wasn't sustainable. And I figured, if I'm killing myself to good quality arak, I'm sure there's other arak lovers on the market who want to get it.
Right.
So I know some friends of mine who only drink arak exclusively, like myself, and they were doing the same thing more or less. So I figured, but maybe then it would be a better feasible route for me just to explore the possibility of trying to make arak. And from there, I just like bought a bunch of books. Like that was back in 2010 on Amazon about distilling and fermentation of grapes and making brandy. Really, I studied how to make cognac and brandy. Mm. And from there, it's like an extra step, how to make haddock. I spent a lot, like a whole year basically reading up on it, different websites, forums, getting books off of Amazon. 2011, I purchased like a really little hobby still. It was like a small 6-liter still, and I was making tiny batches. Mm. And from like 2000, you can say, probably 2011, that was my first batch, all the way up until about, what was it, 2018, like pretty much 2017, I was making like really tiny batches. Mm-hmm. I was making like, I started out with like 20 bottles and 30 and 40, made it up to about almost 100 bottles. Mm-hmm. And then I was basically trying to get people's feedback at first. And then I found that, you know, after I got a recipe down and people enjoyed it, and I incorporated all the feedback that I, you know, seemed to agree with, I decided to up production a little bit, see if I can sell it. You know, there wasn't interest, people are asking me for it. So I figured if people are asking me for it and giving it out for free, I might as well, you know, see if I can make something out on the side.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe one day I can make a business out of it, right? Like over the, because, you know, over here there's a conflict and, you know, people here aren't very wealthy. You have like a very small upper class, and then you have a majority of people that probably don't have a lot of money. And there's a middle class barely exists here. So I guess commercial producers over the year, they began making like this inferior product that they call haddock. And I guess they did it because, you know, if they want to sell, they have to sell something cheap. They need to sell something that people can afford to buy. And they cut a lot of corners, and they began using like 96% industrial alcohol. And they would just buy it in like 1,000 liter containers. They'd knock it down with water to 53%. And then they'd add like anise flavoring to it, like anise flavor. And then it was just like it was a cocktail operation. They just mix and bottle, and that was it.
Sure.
And that's what made this inferior product on the market called haddock. But the problem with that is that people got driven away from haddock. You know, when people have a special occasion or a gathering, or they want to get a gift for somebody, and, you know, they want to get something, you know, that would, you know, reflect, you know, upon themselves as, you know, I got you a nice gift or whatever. Right. They're definitely not going to buy haddock. I mean, haddock was seen as like the poor man's drink and, you know, the drink of the masses. And a lot of people went away from it. So, I mean, like now people, you know, they have this perception that haddock is inferior, and that if you want to drink something good, you got to drink whiskey or tequila. And they went towards the brown spirits. Mm-hmm. So for me, I like, and then people, they forgot all about haddock. Like a lot of people here, like even in Palestine, I'm surprised, like, you know, it's the homeland of haddock. They don't even know how haddock is made. They think it comes from anise, and they don't know that it's actually a grape brandy with anise flavoring. Gotcha. To me, I mean, some people, like my small circle of friends who drink haddock, they were all enthusiastic about it. But the broader people, they just didn't get, like, what I was talking about, like, why are you making haddock? Why not make something else? And some people were like, if you're going to make spirits, go make whiskey. You know, people love whiskey. But for me, I'm passionate about, like, you know, upholding our tradition and our heritage. And for me, I think it's like a travesty to drink whiskey with Palestinian food. I want to revive haddock. You know, yeah. I want to make haddock great again.
Yeah, right. I love that, because you had like, on top of everything else you were doing to make it, you almost had like a rebranding mission to like rebrand Arak to make it something that you could remind people, no, this is actually how amazing it can be.
Yeah, I mean, one of my goals, I want to make people proud of Arak. I want to revive like Arak's like glory, and like, you know, I want Arak to be like, you know, something of national pride. I feel like, you know, if it's these small things, like where we, if we give up on these small, you know, parts of our heritage, you know, that all these little bits, like whether it's food or whether it's whatever, I mean, it makes up the fabric of our identity. And if you give up on it, eventually you'll lose who you are. You lose your culture. You lose your, you know, your sense of self. We have very rich culinary traditions here in Palestine. And in particular, like our distilling heritage is very unique. I mean, if you saw my website, we Arabs in the Levant, we were the first to create distilling. We were the first to make spirits. We were the first to, you know, alcohol is an Arabic word. Alcohol comes from al-kuhl, eyeliner. And that's what the still was created for. Because it was a Muslim alchemist who created it, and he would have never created it for alcohol. But, you know, and when it reached the shores of the Mediterranean, you know, all these countries are saying, what is it? Well, it's alcohol. And now you have all these different spirits around the world who you know, are offshoots of alcohol, whether that's pastis in France or sambuca in Italy or ouzo in Greece,
yes,
or rakı in Turkey and spuro and so on. So, I mean, all these spirits come from this one mother spirit, which is Arak, the oldest spirit in the world.
Wow.
And I just think that, you know, the international community knows enough about the spirit, and I don't think that it gets the respect that it deserves. So definitely I wanted to raise, you know, the aspect of, you know, our Arab distilling heritage. I wanted that to be known. And I just want, you know, like I said, I wanted people to know that. I want to put Palestine on the map and let people know that Palestine produces high quality goods. Regarding the Palestinian narrative, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of one and the same for me. Like, I mean, I try not to go into the politics or the conflict when I talk about my Arak. But I mean, like, that's sort of it. Like, I want just to put ourselves on the map and let people, you know, to share our culture with the international community and, you know, to share with internationally and let the local people see, you know, what we can do with, you know, just the little means that we have here. For me also, like, I'm hypersensitive, like, about into the conflict, like, not for the fact that, you know, like, everyone has a political stance here, like, politics, it's part of our daily lives. You can think our favorite pastime is sitting around talking about politics, but for me, like, I don't want to make it like I don't want to, like, ride the conflict, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to talk about, like, I mean, sure, like, I buy my grapes from farmers and I buy my aniseed from farmers. My grapes in particular, they come from a problematic area. It's an area where Israeli settlements are expanding, and I mean, I have farmers that I buy from who frequently have settlers trespassing on their property. They've been subject to attacks. Oftentimes the military prevents them from reaching their land. But for me, like, I don't want to make it, like, I don't want to exploit the conflict. Like, I don't want to make it, like, part of my marketing. Like, I don't want people to buy my product because it's made in Palestine, because they like Palestine and want to support Palestine. For me, I want people to drink my product because, like, I want them just because they enjoy it. And one of my goals is to make, you know, the world's most respected Arak, and I want to do it as objectively as possible. I want people to, you know, I want the quality to raise my product. I don't want to, you know, I would say, like, I mean, I don't want people, like, I know that sometimes the conflict here can be sexy, and sometimes people might use that when it comes to marketing their goods locally, like, for an international audience. That's not at all for me, and I'm not even trying to target an international audience. For me, like, I mean, I'm barely able to meet local demand. Like, I released my first batch in November, and now I'm completely sold out.
So, Stephen, Nader's been working to triple his output for this year. He went from using a hobby still in his basement to opening and renovating his own distillery with certifications and equipment. So in order to keep up with higher production, he has to secure more grapes from different Palestinian farmers. When I was there with him, it was late September of 2019, and he was checking out the grapes at one of the farms he uses to confirm that they were ready for harvest and delivery. And then he took us to the farm, which was in Area C, so that is under Israeli military occupation, so there are a lot of settlements around there, Israeli settlements who are illegally coming in and setting up homes, and Nader makes it clear he doesn't ever want to commodify the conflict for his product, but I think it's worth noting because he has so many more obstacles to overcome to produce his Arak than someone else. I mean, even the farm we were at, just over the fence, there was an Israeli winery. So they're shipping that out saying it's Israeli wine, but it's grown and produced on Palestinian soil in the West Bank, which was really upsetting. But then we got to see the farm where he harvests from, and then he had this table set up with all this meze, and we were able to eat and drink together, and it was absolutely incredible.
I live in Area C. So Area C, I live in a Palestinian village, but the area I live in, it's under Israeli military control. And all of the areas west of where I live, which are the villages that I'm getting from, they're also under military control. There are, like, checkpoints in the area. I live right next to a military base. But, I mean, it depends on the situation on the ground. When things are tense, there'll be a lot more checkpoints. They'll set up flying checkpoints. They'll be stopping people a lot more often. They don't have so many problems delivering the grapes to me as much as they do have problems trying to care for the grapes. That's kind of how I frame it. I mean, for me, it's not very far. It's like a 5-minute drive. I can be like one of my first vineyards. But for me, it's more of a problem for them, really. I mean, to be honest, they face a lot of problems because they live in like a very sensitive area where Israeli settlements are trying to expand and take over as much territory as they can. Mm-hmm. So they're constantly having, you know, settlers invade their property, either uprooting vines, tearing down vines, bulldozing vines, burning vines. Sometimes they're attacked for being in their land. They try not to stay out there late, so they can only work during specific hours out of fear of being attacked. A lot of like the settlements, they have like a peripheral security or buffer zone. And oftentimes, you know, it's difficult for them to get into their vineyards in those areas, because if they do, they might be arrested by the military.
Oh my God.
So sometimes they do it on like, you know, when it's a Jewish holiday, or if it's a Saturday, it's a holy day for the, you know, so the settlers there aren't necessarily out. Mm-hmm. It's more safe. They feel more safe going out to their vineyards, that sort of thing. But yeah, I wanted to, like, I'm obsessed with authenticity and doing things a traditional way.
So in Palestine, we have 23 indigenous species of grapes. About maybe, you can say 8 or 9 of them are suitable for wine. 3 of which are white varietals, so that I use for my arak. I use primarily Dabuki, but there's also Hamdani and Jandali. The Jandali, you can tell that the berries are smaller, but they're much sweeter. The sugar content in them is crazy. Like you're talking like roughly like 210 grams of sugar per liter. But yeah, so I come and I check periodically, like every week I come and I take samples of all the berries. I try and get like one from each corner of the vineyard, one in the center, different areas. And we decide on a weekly basis which vines to pick. And that's how we go about it generally.
What I do is I just take the grapes, I crush them, and then I throw them in barrels. And then after that second distillation, that's the most complicated. Then we get into the third distillation. For the third distillation, I take that purified spirit, I put it back in the still. I reduce it down to 30% every time, because more than 30%, you're at risk of making an explosion. So I put it back in the still. Usually it's about like 70-something percent. So I water it down to about 30. I put it back in the still. And then I put aniseed in it.
Okay.
And what happens is the aniseed, as it soaks, I'll let it soak for a period of about 24 hours. It'll absorb the ethanol, and it'll release anethol, which is anise oil.
Mm.
And then the next day when I come back and I distill it, basically the anethol and the ethanol will both vaporize together simultaneously. And when I cool that vapor back into a liquid, now it's become one intertwined liquid, which is the basis of arak. And then from there, I'll take it, I'll load it into clay casks. I age it for a year. And roughly after a year or so, I'll just start taking samples towards the end. I can dilute it down to a strength, which is 53%. And then from there, we have arak. And then I hand bottle it and I'm done.
This is a spirit that we're talking about, right? This is not a liqueur,
mm-hmm.
right? Because of the alcohol content right. and the production method. So I'm assuming you had a chance to taste.
Yes.
What were, I mean, because you flew halfway around the world without having tasted this, presumably. So like, the story's interesting, but hopefully it was a bonus if you got to taste it and it was enjoyable.
Oh, absolutely. We had a truly amazing experience with him while we were there. So even to set the scene, when we first met up with him in Jerusalem, Nader wanted to take us to some of his friends' businesses too. So we got to try not only go and experience his product, but also some of his friends who owned ice cream shops where they made Buza Arabia, which is this amazing ice cream that has this elasticity that I've never experienced before in my life. And we went to lots of different places and we had kanafe and it was incredible. So all that leading up, the night before we went to the farm where he harvests his grapes, we went out to a bar that is the only bar that serves his arak. So it was really cool to get to see it on the shelf. And then we actually tried a wine that night that was made from Dabuki grapes. So it was cool to get to experience the full process in that way, where it was like we were tasting the wine from Dabuki grapes. And then the next day we tasted the arak, which was also made from the Dabuki grapes. So when we went to his distillery, he showed us first, he started the distillery in his basement. So we went to the basement of his house. And from there is when he made his first batch. And from that first batch, he submitted it to different festivals in London, in Berlin, in New York, and won awards. Like right away, he came out of the gate, like wanting people to know, like Palestine is a producer of high quality goods. The drink, again, like I said, because it's infused with anise seeds, it has a light licorice taste, but it is really refreshing, and with it pairs perfectly with the meze, so with hummus and with like pickles and olives and baba ganoush and warm fresh pita. It's so divine.
Yes, I love that.
Over ice, is that the best way?
Yes, you can serve it over ice, but one of the interesting things about arak is that when it's bottled, it's a clear liquid, but when you serve it, you dilute it with water and it turns into this cloudy liquid, and that's known as the louche effect. So basically, it's the spontaneous emulsification of the essential oil of the aniseed when it hits the water.
Oh, so beautiful. And I think, you know, a lot of people aren't familiar with the tradition of distilling in this parts of the world, especially when we think of you know, the Islamic community. We think about the opposite, which is an abstinence from alcohol. So
true.
It is a really important part of the reclamation, and fits in so well with the kinds of stories that we see and cover all over the world, you know, where indigeneity is erased and the fight for it to be protected or revived is really the cornerstone of so many producers that we cover. So thank you for bringing us yet another one. This is a really great story. It's great to learn about the indigenous grapes, to learn about you know, how liquor or spirits are produced, of course the geopolitical context, and just the heart and spirit, you know, to actually revive arak is really amazing. So thank you for bringing us this story, and we're really excited to see it in print for volume 6 as well.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been so wonderful to work with you and your team. So I'm excited to see it, and I'm excited for Nader's hard work to be out there for everyone to appreciate.
Thank you so much to our guest, Lyric Lewin and Nader Muwadi. You can read Lyric's full article on Nader and arak in the upcoming volume of Whetstone, Whetstone Volume 6, which will be released this summer. We'd also like to thank our incredible podcast producer, Celine Glager. Celine, you are the best. To our editor and Whetstone partner and director of video, David Alexander in London. Appreciate you, Dave. Thanks to our Whetstone production intern, Quentin LeBeau. And last but not least, my business partner, Mel Shi, who makes all things at Whetstone possible. Thank you, Mel. We'd also like to thank our partners in production at iHeartRadio, to Gabrielle Collins, our supervising producer, and executive producer, Christopher Hasiotis. We'll be back next week with more from the world of food worldwide.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development,
and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.